This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're delighted to be joined by imprisoned radical journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. He tells us what he was doing in 1971, the year the eight activists who recently came forward with their identities broke into the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. And Mumia tells us who some of his ordinary heroes are. We'll talk with an attorney from the ACLU about a lawsuit involving searches at the borders. Every year, thousands of Americans coming home from abroad are subjected to searches of their laptops, cell phones, and other personal devices. Is it legal? We don't think so. Stay with us.
City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Many say it's the best news of the new year. Last week, Judge John Codal granted the Bureau of Prisons' request for the compassionate release of our dear friend and colleague, Lynn Stewart. As our listeners know, Lynn is now 74 years old and has terminal cancer, with a life expectancy of less than 18 months. She'd been serving a 10-year sentence at the Federal Medical Center, Carswell, in Fort Worth, Texas, in connection with her defense of Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. As Lynn's condition continued to deteriorate, literally thousands of individuals from across the globe, as well as several legal and social justice organizations, including the National Lawyers Guild and the Association of American Law Professors, had called on Attorney General Eric Holder to direct the Bureau of Prisons to grant compassionate release. Her medical condition clearly fell within recent reforms to the Bureau of Prisons' compassionate release program, as announced by Attorney Eric Holder this past August. And the warden at FMC Carswell had earlier approved her release. Bob Boyle, one of Lynn's attorneys, said last week, quote, "We're gratified and thankful that the government has agreed to Lynn's compassionate release request. She has dedicated her life to fighting for justice for the underserved and the unpopular. Lynn can now return home to her family and to the community that loves her." From arrest to sentencing, Lynn's case was used by the Department of Justice to send a chilling message to attorneys. Think twice about who you represent. For speaking to a Reuters reporter about her client's views in violation of an administrative order, but notably one that Attorney General Janet Reno treated as just that, an ailing Lynn was sentenced to a decade in prison. "We rejoice Lynn's return home last week to Brooklyn. But note that the damage wrought by the government's unjust prosecution has been enormous, not just to an advocate whose service to society has been widely documented, but to our society as a whole." Lynn is a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild. Since her initial indictment, guild members have educated the public about the many ways her case runs afoul of the Constitution. In 2005, we published a booklet, "The Case of Lynn Stewart, A Justice Department Attack on the Bill of Rights," that Michael Stewart and I, along with many others, put together. It's available at nlg.org. Welcome home, Lynn. We love you. They were responsible for exposing J. Edgar Hoover's infamous counterintelligence programs, collectively referred to as COINTELPRO. Before Dan Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, and decades before WikiLeaks, Chelsea Manning, and Ed Snowden, a group of eight anti-Vietnam War activists on March 8, 1971, burglarized an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, took six suitcases containing secret documents, and sought refuge in a farmhouse, where they pored through the documents before sending selected ones to members of the press. As the rest of the country watched Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier square off in the so-called fight of the century, the efforts of these brave individuals launched one of the most noteworthy exposés of classified information in U.S. history. They called themselves the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. And last week, five of the eight activists made their identities known. At a press conference, the person who actually picked the lock of the FBI office, Keith Forsythe, said, quote, "It has recently come to light that our government is again conducting mass surveillance of Americans, and again lying to Congress and the public about it. We hope that by coming forward today, we can remind Americans of the abuses that unchecked police power can lead to, and contribute in some small way to the ongoing public debate about these recurring issues, which are essential to democracy." The break-in led to extraordinary revelations that began to unravel some of the most damning intelligence community scandals in our history. One memo exposed how Director J. Edgar Hoover's FBI sought to disrupt dissident groups by interviewing activists merely to, quote, "enhance the paranoia endemic in these circles." And a document dated 1968 gave the world its first glimpse of the word COINTELPRO. When they first saw that word, no one knew what it meant. Several years later, a reporter would learn it was shorthand for counterintelligence program. The break-in in Media, Pennsylvania, set off a public debate over domestic surveillance that led eventually to passage of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. One of the burglars, Bonnie Raines, said of Edward Snowden, "I consider him a whistleblower of significance. I think in a democracy we need whistleblowers, regularly, and I don't think he's a criminal. I don't think he's a traitor." A new book titled The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI, by Bonnie Metzger, a former Washington Post reporter and one of the first journalists the activists sent copies of the documents to, came out last week. And a documentary on the subject titled 1971 is forthcoming. And in our final update, later this week, the Senate Judiciary Committee is convening a special session on recommendations to reform the National Security Agency's data surveillance program. This past December, a five-member panel released Liberty and Security in a Changing World. It's a report and recommendations, 46 to be exact, of the President's Review Group on Intelligence and Communications Technologies. Referring to the report, Senator Patrick Leahy said, quote, "The recommendations from the President's Review Group make clear that it is time to recalibrate our government surveillance programs. Momentum is building for real reform." But the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, has noted that there will be much conservative opposition to anything that would reduce the NSA's surveillance activities. The report's recommendations range from no longer storing metadata at the NSA, but by private providers or private third parties, with the spying agency still being able to access the records in certain controlled circumstances. Other recommendations include establishing a Civil Liberties and Privacy Protection Board, a way for whistleblowers to report directly to that board, closing loopholes allowing so-called backdoor access to customers' data through U.S.-based technology companies, and strengthening requirements for security clearances. Authors urged restrictions on the abilities of the secretive Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to compel third parties, such as phone service providers, to reveal customers' private information. On December 16, 2013, Judge Richard Leon ruled that the NSA program was unconstitutional, calling it an indiscriminate and arbitrary invasion of Americans' privacy. And in response, the Department of Justice filed a notice of appeal. But just 2 weeks later, New York Judge William Pauley ruled that the surveillance was lawful. Then, in early January, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court reauthorized the NSA program to gather our phone records in bulk for 90 more days. So we await the Senate Judiciary Committee's special session with much interest and great hope. We at Law & Disorder have kept you updated on his case for the 10 years we've been broadcasting. It is now our pleasure to welcome Mumia Abu-Jamal as our special guest. Professor Johanna Fernandez joins us in the studio as Mumia calls from State Correctional Institution Mahanoy in Frackville, Pennsylvania. Johanna is a professor of history at Baruch College and co-coordinator of the newly launched campaign to bring Mumia home. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm here with Johanna.
Hey. Hi, Mooster.
Hi, Mooster. Last week, we had rather extraordinary news. Five of the eight Media Pennsylvania FBI activist burglars came forth with their identities. Mumia, what were you doing in 1971? Who were you, and what did your world look like?
I remember with quite a degree of distinction receiving in the mail a packet full of Xeroxed FBI files. I believe by 1971 I had left the party. And so this was like a double, triple, a blockbuster. I sat and I read through files that really named names and detailed internal affairs of the Black Panther Party of Philadelphia, the National Office, other organizations, activists all throughout the city and the region. And it was a mind blower, again, especially. Imagine reading about someone that you lived with as a comrade, as a brother in an organization. You know, for what that means is for members of the party, we lived in communal apartments and houses. We lived together, we worked out of the same office, and we spent all day together with each other. And to read about lies that were in those files, and then people that you knew for years who were FBI informants and stuff like that, it was absolutely mind-blowing. But it proved everything that we thought, and it kind of confirmed every suspicion, you know. And it was a different world. So to see this, the news, right, from Media Pennsylvania, is quite refreshing and amazing in many respects that these people held that secret for over 40 years.
Do you think they came forth because of the changing attention to NSA surveillance, Ed Snowden, the other whistleblowers who've come forward?
I think they are the linear ancestors of Edward Snowden. You know, back in those days, you had to find paper, right? Not emails or electronic messages. But these were anti-war people, for the most part, living their own lives, but also wanting to make a contribution, right, to the movement, because they were part of the movement. They were part of the anti-war movement. When we talk about Media Pennsylvania, most of us, unless you're of a certain age, it doesn't ring a bell to you, right? Those files that were ripped off from the media offices of the FBI showed that every organization of any kind of notoriety, actors, artists, women's groups, all kinds of organizations were followed by the FBI, you know, for really practicing their constitutional rights. It was mind-blowing, and I remember very, very well. After that, I think that is the one thing that made the Church Commission hearings possible. And it really exposed what was happening all across the country. It's interesting that these files come out now because, you know, for someone who's been reading and writing recently about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., people know now that the FBI taped hotel rooms where Martin and Ralph David Abernathy and other civil rights activists, you know, were staying, and taped office and phone calls and that kind of stuff. Well, they tried to use those tapes to blackmail Martin King and actually force him into suicide. This was all part of Hoover's plan to destroy the Black Freedom Movement and any movement that was against what the government was doing, any dissenting movement.
Why did you get a copy of those documents? Were you working in Philadelphia as a journalist at the time?
It's entirely possible that I did get those because I was doing some radio work. But it's also possible that people saw my name in it and sent it to me. I mean, I remember getting it and it had, like, no return address, something like Citizens Committee or something like that. And then, of course, the anti-war magazine put out by a group called the Philadelphia Resistance, they had a magazine called When, I believe. They republished those documents, put them in kind of real neat form. And they sent them around to an additional group of activists and journalists. So if you weren't part of the movement or involved in journalism, you got a packet in the mail. You may not have known where it came from, but once you cracked it and read it, boy.
What's fascinating to me as an historian is that in 1971, we know that there was a crisis of legitimacy in government. Americans had lost faith and hope and trust in their government as a result of the Vietnam War, but also the radicalization of the movements. But
this
today,
call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
But today, we are operating in a completely different political atmosphere. And what we see is that Americans are easily tricked into buying the government line that we need to give up our civil liberties and allow broad surveillance of citizens in the name of national security.
Well, I don't think it's literally in the name of national security. Of course, they use those words. You know, the government uses national security to disguise everything. But I think that we can't have this discussion intelligently unless we consider the psychological and then the political impact of 9/11. You know, Bush used to go around saying 9/11 changed everything. It sounded crazy, but there's a certain truth to it. It did change the temperature of America. It did change the psychosis, right? And it reflected the very deep insecurity and fear and paranoia among Americans. So I remember Bush saying stuff like, well, if you don't do what I say, the terrorists win. You know, that kind of stuff. Now we can look back and see that all of that was pure BS. But you couldn't see it on 9/11 or the days and weeks and really years following. It's interesting that Law and Disorder is talking about 9/11 when right there in New York you have an estimated 100 cops who use 9/11 to justify scamming the public, cops, prison guards, and a few firefighters. You know, they would get disability, and they're running around, you know, bicycling or, you know, teaching martial arts, really living high on the hog of the New York and the federal budget. But it gives you a sense of how deeply 9/11 really did change the consciousness of millions of Americans. I think it's changing, but, you know.
We'd like to finish by talking about ordinary heroes. Recently, photographer John Dominus, who snapped the shot of the 1968 Black Power salute with John Carlos and Tommy Smith, died. Actress Juanita Moore, known by many for her role in Imitation of Life, died. Who are your ordinary heroes? I'm not saying they were ordinary people. They were extraordinary, but...
That's a real great question. You know what? When you think about the ordinary heroes, these are people whose names are not known. You know, we can talk about Martin King. We can even talk about, like, Huey P. Newton. But what would they be? And would their names be known to us without the everyday activists, right, who join movements to push them forward? For Martin's case, it was church women for the most part. I mean, think about the Baptist Church. Probably 70% of its population are women and black women.
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
You know, those nameless black mothers and grandmothers, sisters and daughters, they made that movement possible. So they're my heroes. And black people across the country who, sisters again, whose names we don't know for the most part, like Frankie Malika Adams from the Brooklyn chapter, Sister Love from the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party. Them sisters came out at great danger to themselves and built the Black Panther Party essentially from the ground up. So So, you know, we remember the famous brothers, we remember the names of the brothers, but how many of us remember the work and the sacrifice of the sisters? Who got it done? Who made it possible?
Wow. Mumia, what was interesting to hear about the seven who broke into the FBI office was that they were ordinary people who took action because they were not able to live with their conscience anymore. I think that's important because we tend to think that society is changed by incredibly brave, out of the ordinary human beings. But when we look at history, it's ordinary people who change history who were driven by their moral conscience.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the proverbial head, because to look at them now, I mean, people perhaps in their 60s and 70s, these are the most average people in the world. But they're average people who felt two things, that the protests, right, carrying signs and, you know, camping and marching around the Pentagon, you know, sending a letter to the editor was not enough. And they resolved on their own. I mean, I've always wondered who these people were. I never knew, obviously. They resolved on their own, right, to take an action that really had historic transformation in terms of democracy and showing people what the government was doing. Even if you think of Edward Snowden, he's really quite an average guy. No college education to speak of. He's just like a computer whiz. Now, he got a great job, and he resolved in his mind, in his heart, in his soul, that he would not be silent about the things he saw and heard. And while it's too early to say history has been changed, I think we all can agree his revelations and the stuff he's released has had a profound impact, not just on American society or American politics, but you've got people in Brazil, people in India, people in Germany, and people in France, and people in England talking about it. That's pretty remarkable. That's one man.
There's a whole lot of disorder, however, in his actions. He broke the law, as did the seven who broke in. What are your thoughts?
Indeed, that is true. And the media people waited until the statute of limitations, but also the political temperature change. I think, like I said, that Snowden had an impact on them. You know, Martin King said that there are laws that need to be broken because some laws are fundamentally unjust. Laws should serve men, not men serve laws.
It's so good to hear your voice.
30 seconds remaining.
At the 30-second countdown, we want to say we love you.
We love you. And we're going to bring you home.
That's
yes.
That's what I'm talking about. Thank
home
both of
soon.
Y'all. Let's continue making law and disorder. On
a
move.
On a move. Another great visit with Mumia.
It's humbling to know that the United States can incarcerate one of the most important public intellectuals of our time. That interview is a really beautiful display of both Mumia's intellect and his understanding of history, but also of his humanity. It's chilling to hear those words in the context of the noise in the background. He's behind bars in prison. And what you hear, the hundreds of other men who are warehoused at SCI Mahanoy.
Johanna, we have some exciting news to share with our listeners, and that is a new campaign. You've been very active in helping pull this together with hundreds of other individuals. It's called Bring Mumia Home. Tell us about it.
So the campaign to bring Mumia home is a formation that emerges in this new period when Mumia is out of death row. And what's interesting, Heidi, is that many people thought that after Mumia was released from death row, the movement would quiet down, but what we've seen is in fact the opposite. And the campaign to bring Mumia home has drawn to the movement a new generation of activists who came of age after the 1990s, when there was a massive international movement coalescing to save Mumia's life and to keep the state from executing him. So these young people are now being introduced to this phenomenal human being whose story of resistance against the state has captured their imagination. The campaign to bring Mumia home is bringing together the different currents within the movement to free Mumia. And of course, that movement has been long led by PAM Africa of the International Concerned Friends and Family of Mumia Abu-Jamal and other important people with this new cohort. And we are in the process of thinking through a political strategy that's going to mainstream Mumia, but also break open ground zero in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and that's Philadelphia, where the Fraternal Order of Police has ideological hegemonic power, right? They have an enormous amount of influence in Philadelphia, but we are going to ground zero, and we're launching a campaign that is going to mainstream Mumia in Philadelphia, and we've begun. So quickly, we got coverage on December 9th in Philadelphia. December 9th, as your listeners know, marked the 32nd year of Mumia's incarceration. And every year, the movement holds some kind of event. And we held a press conference. We also had a series of other activities with young people. We even had a series of yoga sessions titled Free Your Mind, Free Mumia, Free Them All. And we got coverage in the Philly Weekly.
What's the website? I know Mumia's 60th birthday is coming up in April. It's going to be on us soon, and I understand there are actions planned about that. But I think the coordinating website is an important place for our listeners to check out.
Minutes after midnight on New Year, our incredible website went live. You must check it out. It's bringmumiahome.com.
Bringmumiahome.com.
I want to instruct your listeners to turn up the music when you go to the website. And just a little story, we were in the midst of pulling it all together. We were very excited. A lot of the young people who are now part of the movement helped us build the site. And we asked Mumia, we know that you've never seen the World Wide Web, and you know not what a website looks like, but if you had to imagine something on a website, what would it be? And he said, music. And so we've added music to the website, and it's quite beautiful, and it's quite powerful.
If anyone listening to us would like to join the campaign to bring Mumia home, email bringmumiahome@gmail.com. And be sure to mention that you heard about it on Law and Disorder. Professor Johanna Fernandez, thank you so much for all that you've done in Mumia's case and to draw attention to political prisoners around the globe, really, and for joining us in this wonderful interview with Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Thank you so very much for your work on Law and Disorder. And before I go, I should tell you that I visit a prisoner in New Jersey who told me that he listens to Law and Disorder from prison. So the work you do really touches the hearts of people who really need to hear that there are people who are on the right side of justice.
Thank you. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Each year, thousands of American citizens returning from abroad are subjected to searches of their laptops, cell phones, and other personal devices. The Department of Homeland Security claims it has the right to such searches, regardless of whether the traveler is suspected of any wrongdoing. A federal court recently dismissed a 2010 lawsuit against the DHS. The ACLU and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers filed the suit on behalf of Pascal Abidor, a dual French-American citizen whose laptop was searched and confiscated at the Canadian border, and also on behalf of the National Press Photographers Association and the NACDL. Abidor was traveling from Montreal to New York on Amtrak when his computer was searched and taken by customs officers. He was questioned, removed from the train in handcuffs, and held in a cell for several hours. When his laptop was returned, many of his files, chats, and photos had been searched. Joining us today is Brian House with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project to talk about this and other cases. Brian, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, many of our listeners probably didn't realize that we can be subjected to searches on Amtrak. Tell us, if you will, briefly the facts of Mr. Abidor's search and how that happened.
Sure thing. Mr. Abidor is a dual United States and French citizen and a PhD student in Islamic studies at McGill University. He had his laptop searched and confiscated at the Canadian border while traveling home to New York on an Amtrak train in May 2010. During the stop, Mr. Abidor was approached by a government agent who looked over his passport and asked what he was studying. And on that basis, the agent was able to figure out that Mr. Abidor was a graduate student in Islamic studies and that he had recently traveled to the Middle East, Egypt, Lebanon, Yemen, etc. And on that basis, she called him into the cafe car for further examination of his laptop. Now, the agent opened Mr. Abidor's laptop and started, you know, looking through the files on his desktop. And, you know, she found a couple pictures, which she showed to the agents around her. Mr. Abidor couldn't actually see what she was looking at the time. But she turned the laptop around and asked him what he thought about these two pictures she had identified. One was a picture of a Hamas rally in Israel, and another picture was of a Hezbollah rally in Lebanon. Mr. Abidor explained that these pictures were related to his graduate work in Islamic studies, and that's why he had them. But the agents thought that these pictures were particularly suspicious, and so they took Mr. Abidor off the train. You know, the train left the station without him. They put him in handcuffs, and they placed him into a holding cell where he was forced to wait for several hours. While he was there, the agents interrogated him about his studies, his associations, his interest in Islam, why he traveled to the Middle East, etc. Eventually, they decided that there was no evidence of wrongdoing, and so they decided to let him go. But not before seizing all of his electronic devices and specifically detaining his laptop for an indefinite period of time. When the government finally returned Mr. Abidor's laptop 11 days later, he was able to determine from the last open date on his files that the government had actually inspected his personal photographs, a transcript of a chat he had with his girlfriend, copies of his email correspondence, class notes, journal articles, tax returns, his graduate school transcript, and even his resume. And so as a result of that, he decided to come to us, and we brought a lawsuit on his behalf challenging this policy.
Okay, now before we get into the specifics of the lawsuit, I also wanted to ask you about another similar case in many ways of an individual named David House, who was also interrogated about his political activities, and DHS apparently seized his laptop computer as well as his phone, camera, and USB drive. Can you tell us the facts in that case?
Yes, certainly. David House is a very talented computer programmer who lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he was at one time deeply involved in the Bradley Manning support network. Bradley Manning, as you know, or now Chelsea Manning, was the Army private who disclosed a number of State Department cables to WikiLeaks, and the government was very interested in investigating this individual as a result of those disclosures. So the government figured out that Mr. House was related to Chelsea Manning, and they wanted to question him in connection with the WikiLeaks investigation. And what they did was they set up an alert in the government's database, what's known as the text database, and it let the government know whenever Mr. House was leaving the country. So when Mr. House booked plane tickets to Mexico to go on a trip with his girlfriend, the system alerted the government that Mr. House would be leaving the country. And when Mr. House returned, government agents were waiting for him at Chicago O'Hare. They interrogated Mr. House about his connection to WikiLeaks and his political activities. And then they, as you mentioned, confiscated his laptops and his other electronic devices.
But let's be clear. There was no suspicion of any unlawful activities. We're talking pure political speech, in effect.
That is correct. At the end of the day, when we actually brought a lawsuit on Mr. House's behalf and ultimately settled with the government, the DHS notes, after reviewing all of his materials, after going through every file on his laptop and exhaustively searching through all the electronic device information he had, concluded that there was absolutely no evidence to seize any of these devices. So they had no evidence of wrongdoing. And there was strong reason to believe that they knew this from the beginning and that they knew that they could never get a probable cause warrant issued by a judge. And so that's why they decided to wait until he was at the border where conveniently, under current government policy, and as many courts have interpreted the law, the government does not need any sort of suspicion to pick up a traveler, take their electronic devices, and search through everything inside them.
Now, as you mentioned, in his case, there was a text data alert about his travel plans. Are you suggesting that if there is a group of politically active individuals in the United States, the DHS can put such an alert on when we might be traveling across a border, and then because of this lessened standard for suspicion, no need for suspicion, they might wait until we're crossing a border to question us?
As we understand it, the DHS can put anyone it likes into its text database and can then do exactly as you say, can wait till they come back from an international trip, stop them at the border, question them, take their electronic devices, and inspect them as fully as the government wishes to do so.
And do you have any idea of the numbers of such searches that are conducted on an annual basis?
Our understanding is that between October 1st, 2008 and June 2nd, 2010, more than 6,500 people, nearly 3,000 of them United States citizens, were subjected to a search of their electronic devices as they crossed the United States borders.
One thing in the House case, and I'm not sure if I'm accurate on this, but I think I read that after the physical devices were returned to him, government agents continued to investigate copies of his files. Do they make, to the best of your knowledge, copies of some of these files and keep them?
Our understanding is that the standard government practice, when it obtains a traveler's electronic device for forensic examination, is that it makes a copy of everything on the device, what's known as a mirror of the device. And it does this because inspecting files can actually change the content of the information in those files. And so to make sure that it has a completely clean copy of everything just as it was when the device was picked up, it makes a copy of the device. And then in Mr. House's case, for example, the government often makes further copies if it needs to share this information with other government agencies. In Mr. House's case, DHS originally picked up the device, but it decided it needed special help from the Army's Criminal Investigative Division, and so it made another copy of Mr. House's files and distributed that to the Army so that the Army could conduct its own forensic examination of the materials.
Why the Army?
My best guess as to why the Army was particularly involved in this case is because it was Army documents that were retrieved by Chelsea Manning and sent over to WikiLeaks. But we, you know, we don't actually know. The government didn't give us the specific reason why it asked the Army to get involved. It just said that it needed special subject matter and technical expertise that the Army's Criminal Investigative Division
and
could provide.
Maybe this is part of your case, which I do want to talk about, the pending case, but or the case that you just dismissed.
Yes.
But is there an issue of reasonable duration for which the government can hold on to information? Doesn't that become an unreasonable seizure if they keep these documents for an extended period of time?
We certainly think so. And the district court in Massachusetts, in Mr. House's case, did suggest in denying the government's motion to dismiss in that case that the extended period that the government held on to Mr. House's devices might very well have been unreasonable given the total absence of suspicion. The government claims that no constitutional constraints bind it in determining how long it can detain a traveler's devices. It claims the legal authority to detain traveler's devices indefinitely. It has set up some guidelines to suggest that after 30 days, a device should be returned if feasible and further review must be, you know, implemented to make sure that the continued retention of that device is necessary. But the documents in Mr. House's case reveal that oftentimes there's just considerable delay for bureaucratic reasons. Agents take sick leave, machines break, stuff like that. And the government, as a matter of course, just continues the detentions. And so it often seems that these policies about prompt return that the government has implemented for itself are not followed.
Going back to the Abidor case, which I believe also included the National Press Photographers Association and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Yes, that's correct.
That was just dismissed. Does the ACLU have plans to appeal yet?
We are currently considering whether or not to appeal the case.
And why was the National Press Photographers Association and NACDL, why were they included in the case?
So we included those association plaintiffs because they both have professional concerns about maintaining the integrity of their information. You know, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers obviously regularly engages with individuals they take on as clients, people who are suspected of wrongdoing by the United States government. And those people have a very strong and important interest in making sure that their attorney-client privilege is not violated when the government picks up criminal defense attorney at the border and opens up their laptop and looks through everything on the laptop. And in fact, one of the criminal defense lawyers had her laptop examined at an airport by government agents. And so that's why they were involved in the case. The National Press Photographers Association, they also travel internationally. They also regularly engage with individuals who might have an interest in not having the United States government reading through all their correspondence. You know, these are people who, you know, might want to remain very private about their lives, not because necessarily they're engaged in any criminal wrongdoing, but just because, you know, ideologically they don't like the idea of the government snooping around in their interviews. And reporters
and there's confidentiality of sources.
Yes, reporters and photographers have an important duty to their sources to maintain confidentiality. And so the Press Photographers Association also had, you know, one of their photographers while traveling, I think, across the United States border, also from Canada, had his phone, you know, picked up and examined by government agents, and they went through all his pictures and they, you know, unrolled his film and stuff like that. And again, you know, that violates the confidentiality and the professional obligations he has to the people he works with.
Well, it's interesting because we're seeing so much in other aspects of NSA spying and surveillance and data storage, how both reporters are, I think, suffering from the so-called chilling effect, knowing that there's increasing scrutiny and desire to get at some of their sources. What this reminds me of is years ago when the Bureau of Prisons changed its regulations after the events of 9/11, to permit eavesdropping on attorneys and certain clients. Wasn't there set in place a mechanism, if you know, so that there would be certain protection of privileged information? A third party, I think, would review it. And it sounds like on these border searches, that intermediary process to even keep up the facade that you're trying to preserve confidentiality doesn't exist.
There are some protections at the border when an agent who looks at an electronic device realizes that he's actually looking at attorney-client correspondence. In those circumstances, the agent, I believe, is supposed to alert the DHS General Counsel's office about what he's looking at. And if he believes that the things he's looking at, you know, still are important, you know, as part of the investigation, the counsel's office will allow him to continue looking through those files. So there is some internal protection on it, but as you know, as a factual matter, that doesn't mean that these files aren't looked at regularly. The DHS General Counsel's office merely needs to be informed that it's going on.
Okay, now the ACLU filed a FOIA request for DHS documents. What did you ask for and what did you get?
What we asked for in our FOIA request was the DHS Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Impact Report on border searches, which the government had announced many years ago, but never actually published or disclosed. What we got, and we asked also for all the supporting documents underlying that report. We ultimately got the report with some redactions, particularly pertaining to the government's legal analysis of why it's allowed to engage in suspicionless searches. But ultimately, the document concluded that it would be unwise for the government to voluntarily institute a reasonable suspicion requirement for border searches, simply because it would then have to justify those searches before a judge, and that would constrain agents who sometimes need to engage in inarticulable hunches when deciding who to subject to these incredibly intrusive searches, and that was just too much to ask of the government.
So there's really no standard here.
There really is not. The government claims the authority to look at the devices anytime somebody crosses the border and with regards to any person whatsoever. And particularly troubling in the report, there was some suggestion that at least some airports there had been racial profiling involved in the use of these border searches. The report ultimately concluded after a subsequent statistical analysis that the previous indications that there might be racial profiling were not valid, but because we never got the underlying documents, we can't verify the government's statistical manipulations in that regard.
Do you know of any persons who have refused to submit to a search? Are they then asked to just leave the train or disembark from the airplane, or are they detained?
We are not aware of anybody who has actually refused the search. My understanding is that they would likely be detained. We are currently trying to figure out, through a variety of means, what the government's policies are in this area. It's kind of amazing that we don't know what happens if, as a United States citizen, you refuse to be subject to the search. My reading of the cases is that the only basis for denying a citizen entry into the United States is if you believe that they're not a citizen. So if a person, I think, said that they simply refused to have their laptop searched, I think legally the government's only recourse would be to just take the laptop from the person.
Right.
I don't think that they could indefinitely prevent them from entering the country as a result of that. But we simply don't know what the government thinks the law is in this area because it hasn't told us yet.
And I'm assuming then there's no signage, say, on Amtrak that says, or there may be signage saying you're subjected to a search, but does it get more specific than that?
I am not aware
on the trains?
Of any signage myself.
Okay.
I haven't inspected it recently, so I can't
right.
say.
Brian, before we wrap up, we'd love to hear more about what you do with the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project. What other cases are you handling?
Sure thing. So the Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project has a pretty broad portfolio, actually. We deal with the traditional First Amendment cases for which the ACLU is famous, and also with, as the name implies, privacy cases, Fourth Amendment cases, such as the ones raised here, and then also just cases involving new technologies. I think one of the cases I'm most proud of that we did in the past year was Myriad Genetics, which was the breast cancer gene patenting case. And we won a 9-0 decision from the United States Supreme Court holding that Myriad Genetics could not own the patents to the genes that cause breast cancer, and so that research can continue by other entities without having to go to Myriad Genetics for its permission on breast cancer. But, you know, that's one example of the kind of technology-related work that we do.
And I bet most of the general public is unaware of the repercussions of that. What an important case.
I think so. I think that's actually one of the most important cases we've litigated in the past 5 years.
And do you do other work that's related to genetics?
That was DNA? Our first genetics case. And, you know, that came up simply because we had a staff scientist at the time who came into Chris Hansen's office. Chris Hansen's now retired, but he was a senior lawyer with the project. And she said, did you know that companies can patent genes? And Chris Hansen said, that's crazy. You can't possibly believe that, you know, there's no way the law would permit that. Those are obviously things in nature. You can't patent nature. And she said, well, the Federal Circuit has held that this company can patent genes, and they've patented them, and they're charging other people to do breast cancer research or even just to do breast cancer tests. So let's say you thought you might have a genetic predisposition to breast cancer. You could use the Myriad Genetics test, but if you wanted to get a second opinion, you simply couldn't get one.
That's astonishing.
And so he was just so outraged by that he filed a case. And, you know, at the time, people were suggesting that we should be disbarred because we were filing frivolous lawsuits. but ultimately, we were vindicated very happily. And I think, you know, it really is one of the cases I'm most proud of.
Yes. And how difficult to take on large either pharmaceutical or, you know, health-related companies such as that.
It's very unusual for us. You know, we're used to suing the government, but we're not used to suing these private companies. Some other work that we've done recently, we were involved in a lot of the litigation following the United States Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Jones.
That the was GPS monitor.
Yes,
yes.
The GPS tracking case. Mm. There, the Supreme Court, you know, held that the placement of a GPS tracker on someone's car and the monitoring of that tracker violated the Fourth Amendment, and at least five justices suggested in various concurrences that long-term monitoring of someone's location over time could violate reasonable expectations of privacy and therefore violate the Fourth Amendment. And so we were involved as amici in that case. And now that the case is over and that victory is in hand, we've been going throughout courts, you know, in the country, filing amicus briefs in criminal defense cases, trying to expand the Jones ruling to cover other forms of long-term location tracking.
Would that include drones at all?
That hasn't included drones yet, although I'd be interested to see what happens in the future. Mainly, that has included stuff like cell site location information.
Right.
So when the government, you know, asks cell companies to divulge all the cell towers that your cell phone has been near for the past 30 days, basically. We have, you know, the government has been using that information in cases, and now we're using Jones to argue that the use of that kind of long-term location tracking, looking at a person's cell phone records over months at a time, violates reasonable expectations of privacy and violates the Fourth Amendment.
Right. Let's just conclude with a sort of global overview. Are you feeling hopeful in light of the recent White House 5-person panel recommending reforms to the NSA surveillance program? How do you feel as we start 2014 that a lot of these cases, you know, we have differing court decisions on the constitutionality of NSA programs? Are you feeling that we're having a sea change in terms of public awareness, that perhaps the government, along with corporations, have gone too far in monitoring our privacy?
I think so. I think this is an incredibly exciting time. I think it's a crucial time for having a debate about what our understanding of privacy is going to be in the coming century. I think that Mr. Snowden's revelations have opened the door in a once-in-a-generation way on the deep state and the sort of secret government surveillance that nobody knew was occurring for decades. And now we're finally, it's finally out in the open, and people are actually learning about what the government's been doing in their name, how pervasively the government and also private corporations have been monitoring them. And so finally we can actually talk about whether or not this is the right thing to do. You know, before these revelations came out, we tried to have the debate, but it was always very hard because we could only speculate as to what the government was doing. And in fact, we were kicked out of the Supreme Court in 2013. In Amnesty International v. Clapper, the Supreme Court held that we didn't have standing to challenge these government dragnet collection policies because we just couldn't show that lawyers like us or journalists were having their communications intercepted by the government. But Mr. Snowden showed that, in fact, everybody's communications are being intercepted by the government. And so now the government can no longer say that our concerns are hypothetical and forestall the debate that way. Now we have to actually confront what we know has been going on. And I think that, you know, hopefully that debate is what's necessary for democracy to function.
I thought it was pretty exciting as well that recently several of the individuals who broke into the Media Pennsylvania FBI offices came forth with their identities.
Yes, that was such a great story. I actually bought that book last night, and I'm reading it now.
I'm looking forward to it, too.
It's really timely.
Well, Brian, it's really been an honor to have you on, and we look forward to staying in touch about your future cases and successes.
Oh, thanks very much. I hope to come on again sometime soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.